the topic for our roundtable today is Patient Needs, Medical Technologies, Inequalities and New Imaginary Futures. And in this roundtable, we hope to focus on the role of patient needs around shaping health equalities and inequalities, how these might have triggered the sort of making or the unmaking of medical technologies over time, and how things might change and adapt in the future as well. So the sort of format for this evening's session will be we have four wonderful speakers who are going to speak for about 10 or 12 minutes each, followed by perhaps one or two quick questions from the floor if there's anything, you have any burning questions about the talks. And then after everyone's given their talks, then we'll bring the speakers together for a panel discussion, and hopefully then we'll have a good discussion linking the themes and ideas that have come out from all four talks. So first of all, I would like to welcome Dr. Cathy Eberholm, who's a reader in medical sociology at the Centre for Reproductive Research at De Montfort University. She was awarded her PhD in sociology from the University Libre de Bruxelles, and has previously visited King's College London, the London School of Economics and Political Science, and the University of Ottawa. And her main research interests are in the sociological and anthropological study of family, biotechnologies and genetics, with a particular focus on reproductive decision-making, multi-parenthood and gender issues. And today she's going to talk about the legalisation of mitochondrial donation in the UK in 2015, and we'll touch on the question of who has benefited from it. So I'll hand over the floor to
Thank you. Good evening, everyone, and thank you first to the organizers for organizing this event, for inviting me, and for welcoming us so well so far. So I would like to start with a few thoughts on the theme of hope and the different facets it took for the patients in the context of the debate on mitochondrial donation. This high-profile reproductive techniques aimed at preventing the transmission of mitochondrial disorders. So as you might know, these techniques were legalized for the very first time in the UK in 2015, following extensive parliamentary and public debates. But whilst the ethical and safety issues were discussed at length, the potential benefits to patients and their access to technologies in practice were rarely questioned. Instead, the mitochondrial debate was characterized by a dominant narrative of hope about the perceived needs of patients, where mitochondrial donation was positioned as a desired technological solution and the only hope for women. At the time of the debate, I was doing research on the experience of the reproductive experiences of the women at risk of transmitting this very specific mitochondrial disorders. And I was surprised by the stark contrast I could see between the great expectations surrounding these techniques, which were voiced by some of the patients in the media, and the range of difficulties the women I was interviewing were facing when it came to make reproductive choices. And these difficulties and issues were largely ignored in the debate. I was also intrigued by the fact that many women I interviewed would not be able and were not willing to use the techniques themselves to have children, but were nonetheless in favor of the techniques and were at times very involved in the public debates. So with one of my colleagues who was also studying similar issues, Rebecca Diamond, we decided to explore further these questions and to put the data together to gain a better understanding of how patients' perceptions, actions, and identities were shaped by these narratives of hope. So the question we addressed was why participants did support the legalizations of these techniques and indeed invested their time and energy in the campaigns to legalize them when they might not be planning to use the technique themselves. Overall, what does hope mean for patients in the context of emerging reproductive technologies, and what are the implications of such powerful discourse? So I will summarize here briefly the key points of the findings based on the two separate research projects. So first of all, among the participants, only three women did not support it or completely the legalization of the techniques. either because they haven't heard about the techniques or for religious convictions. But the rest of the participants explained at length why they supported the techniques. However, and interestingly, as I said before, they did not necessarily support mitochondrial donation because they wanted to use the techniques themselves. Indeed, some participants did not want to use any assisted reproductive technologies, some others didn't want to have children, or they were just too ill to think of raising a child. And their stories highlighted the various facets of hope which were represented by the techniques that we've tried to summarize under three different themes. So the first of them was hope for self. So, and this is the case of the participant for which the techniques represented a real opportunity to improve their own chances to have unaffected and biological children. It was also a way for some of them not to reproduce the traumatized experiences that they had or some of their relatives experienced through the disease. So while some respondents did so supported the techniques because they believed they were in position to use them, this group of women were, however, in a minority. They were the younger participants of a sample, and they were the ones who did not have children yet. But for the majority, there was not such a direct link between supporting the technique and wishing to or being in a position of using the technique themselves. So then there were some respondents who spoke about the future benefits of mitochondrial donation for their daughters. For example, by offering an additional reproductive option and allowing their daughters to have children without fear of having the disease. So this is what we have called hope for the family. And it's interesting in that respect to see how this participant was projecting a particular future for their daughters, projecting their own experience but incorporating new knowledge into their reasoning. And eventually there was like a third category we call hope for society. And this was the case of like a majority of participants who highlighted the wider benefits of such technologies in terms of supporting the reproductive choices of other women and for society. So overall, one could see the ubiquity of hope in patients' perception of mitochondrial donation. Participants supported their legalization for a number of reasons, including for personal reasons. But supporting the technologies on behalf of others present a different account in terms of the narrative of hope. And this type of hope was rarely represented in the media or public debates, where it was always framed as a way of stopping the suffering of young children. So not only were most women we interviewed in favor of mitochondrial donation, but many of them also actively supported the techniques by becoming involved in the related debates. And engagement could take like a lot of different forms. So some contacted the MP or meet with them. Some assisted at the, attended debate at the parliament, or asked their friends to vote in favor, like to tweet in favor of the technique. Some also even offered eggs for research. But whatever the nature and extent of the involvement, it's important to emphasize that in the mitochondrial donation debates presented the first opportunity for most participants to become involved in activities on a public stage. And patients took up the opportunity with enthusiasm and passion. Engaging in the debate has been empowering for some participants. So we could really hear that during the interview where some of them were saying like they were participating, this will have an effect in their future, they were part of their history. But it's also important to insist that their contribution were highly valued and they were able to be presented as having a direct experience of the disorders and being potential users of the techniques. As such, they provided evidence of the desirability and essentiality of mitochondrial donation. And in this respect, we can see how the mitochondrial donation debates remind us of the importance of the political context when we are examining hope. It followed a format which is increasingly familiar when discussing novel technologies, where the technology is framed as what patients want, and the patient experience is showcased as support. So mobilized by the clinics and the support groups, patients in the mitochondrial debate were framed as users and as drivers of the technologies, even if they didn't design this role for themselves. Am I still fine with that?
Yeah.
I'm reaching the conclusion. So the mitochondrial debates have no doubt increased public awareness and raised the profile of a rare genetic disease. But these debates were limited in scope, particularly around how the patient experience was presented. Mitochondrial disease is a complex condition, highly variable, and for many people with late onset. The representation of mitochondrial disease as only affecting seriously ill children does not do justice to the experience of the many adults currently living with mitochondrial disease. Moreover, in comparison to the dominant narrative that women will use mitochondrial donation to have their own healthy genetic baby, the nuanced reasons as to why women might support the legalization of reproductive technologies were much less represented within media accounts. So the case of mitochondrial donation also suggests that patients' options were shaped by the technologies currently being developed, so reproduction instead of treatment, and by the political will of the scientists and clinicians who are developing them. So patient power, in the case of mitochondrial donation, was restricted to public engagement to support the legalization of one technology with limited potential to their current lives. Moreover, this involvement was short-term for most patients, and we can therefore wonder to what extent this patient experimented some kind of false hope. So just to conclude, finally, if the combination of hopeful technologies with the power of patient support is to become the norm for public engagement strategies around the introduction of novel biotechnologies, as is, for example, the case with genome editing at the moment, then we need to think more carefully about how patient activities are directed towards scientific agendas, who is directing, and who or what is excluded from the political economy of hope, particularly when technologies are not going to improve the health of those living with disease. Thank you.
So our second speaker tonight is Dr. Manuela Parata, who is a lecturer in technology and organisation at the Queen Mary University of London. She holds a PhD from the University of Trento, and Manuela is also an affiliated researcher at ReproSoc in Cambridge. She's currently a Wellcome Trust investigator on a team project titled Remaking the Human Body, Biomedical Imaging Technologies, Professional and Lay Visions. And the main research interests concern the relations among learning, work, and innovation organisations, particularly in the field of healthcare and biotechnologies. And I will leave Manuela to introduce her talk to us. So thank you, Manuela.
Thank you very much, first of all, to the organiser for inviting us. I will present shortly some initial findings of the research we are doing. This is a quite large project, and I have two other people working with me. We're also looking at patient and professional, so it's a variety of issues that are going to be all together. But we're right in the middle, so there's no conclusion yet. What we are studying now is basically time-lapse embryo monitoring in the field of IVF. This is a new technology that basically allows to take repeated pictures of embryos in the 5 days where you're usually supposed to be in the lab. I just put the video on so that you can see what kind of picture they take. And it's a very basic sort of innovation. It was not possible to do it in the past because of technical reasons. The light was not right and it was supposed to damage the embryo, but nowadays this is possible. So I was just trying to build how this actually came out. It was possible because of other technical innovation. it was very, very wanted by the medical doctor, because looking at the embryo every second day was giving very limited information on the job that they were doing on an everyday basis. So this machine basically allows to record a very larger amount of information that then is producing a lot of other knowledge. Also, IVF rates are pretty poor. Just to give you an average, it's around 30% success rate. But when they say 30%, they mean it depends on the age of the patient, the number of cycles you're actually considering. So success rate is really an issue in terms of failure in IVF. But it was also involved in a sort of very early marketing where the machine, as very often happened in IVF, the new technologies have often presented as the thing that is going to solve infertility now and forever in this sort of very grand expectation of what the machine or a treatment can do. Now, after we started the research, time-lapse was actually inserted in the list of add-ons. I don't know how familiar you are with this, but in 2016, there was a BBC documentary that focused on how, especially in private clinics, add-ons, which are basically additional treatment that patients pay for when they're doing IVF cycle, are sold for some sort of expensive price sometimes, as you can see. And these are additional. So mainly the rhetoric of this add-on was this is going to produce better chance of getting a success, which usually means an alive baby. So after this BBC documentary, there was this sort of big change that happened in the public debate in the UK, where the main discourse, the public discourse, concentrate on the evidence and the quality of the evidence, and especially on the lack of evidence of the additional treatment. Although from my point of view here, the real issue is the cost of this additional treatment rather than the evidence per se. To try to solve this public controversy, the HFEA started to produce what is now called, it was initially called the traffic light system, but now they don't call it this way anymore. They call it like the rating system, where they are rating the quality of evidence for different add-ons. And as you can see, none of this is green. So it means there's no good evidence for any of the things that is currently offered in the UK in every NHS, not every NHS, but both in NHS and private treatment. The difference is that from the early days, the strategy, the marketing strategy that you can read on the website, when I wrote the project in 2015, it was about more pregnancies. Now they're saying the knowledge, it's safe, it's better, it produces more understanding. So there's been quite a change in terms of the marketing strategy, and also a change in the offer. A lot of clinics just decide that this is a piece of equipment that is useful for the lab, so it's included in the price of an IVF cycle. And a lot of NHS clinic just have it inside the NHS treatment. The problem is that from this point of view, this increase the already existing inequalities that already exist and are pretty strong in the UK, because the NICE guidelines are saying that every woman should have access to at least 3 cycles. These currently happen only in Scotland. Across the UK, there is what is called the lottery, the postcode lottery, because it depends on what is the decision of the local council. And then this is connected to the volume of investment that is done in IVF and in the number of treatment that patients can actually access. So if the time-lapse is actually available in the fertility clinic where you're having the treatment or it's not, is making a further distinction in the kind of quality of the treatment that you can actually have. But I want to show you, sometimes there is this idea of promising technology or promissory technology, but I took two very different understanding of what this means. The first one comes from the HFEA leaflet, where they're trying to say, look, there's no evidence, we are not sure, we cannot say there's going to be more pregnancy. So they're saying, initial research has shown some promise, but it's still very early days. There is certainly not enough evidence to show that time-lapse imaging improves birth rates, which is something you might want to consider if it's being offered to you at an extra cost. So they report this sort of very common narrative around a lot of medical technology where it's promising, the future is going to be better, and we need further research, but it's in a sort of positive way. And the problem is if you have to pay now for a technology that is not already giving you what they promised. But then we had some interview with patients. We did interview 22 patients so far, and some of them were saying something very different in terms of what actually they're promising. It wasn't about the imaging. It was about this idea of them, the embryos, being safer because they're not being disturbed, not being touched. So when you actually start to see what are the experience of the people that are actually going through IVF, the kind of attention they have can turn in a lot of different ways. I'm not suggesting this is representative of the 22 women we interview. It's just the understanding of what it means to be, to what it promises in terms of patient treatment can be very different. And also, what I think sometimes the main discourse is missing is that this idea of IVF failure is so common for infertile people and for infertile patients, because usually when you reach the IVF, at least all the women we have interviewed, there's no one who has started IVF out of the blue that morning. Clearly it's quite a journey, what it's usually called, and it's a journey made of failure, of emotions, of... I'll just read what one of these patients said. The emotion that you, I, one, has surrounding infertility are so destructive. Yeah, it's emotion, you know. You can get into some very dark places, and whatever offers a glimmer of light, you're drawn towards, I think, yeah. So from the perspective of the patient, clearly any add-on just means a bit more hope of what you can actually get in the treatment. And payment is something that you are prepared to do in a very different experience of this journey, which is made of a lot of effort. And there is also this other kind of narrative that is pretty dominant. You take hope from the stories you hear about, you know, people who were told to give up, and they didn't, they defied the doctors, now they're sat there looking at their 2-year-old child around, or whatever. So there is these two narratives that are kind of going together, that you are supposed to suffer is a very difficult thing, is very emotionally invasive, and at the same time you need to still keep going. So in our understanding, my understanding so far, these kind of IVF narratives are actually also shaping the way in which the patient needs are expressed by the patient, and somehow in a strange way reported by the clinician that we are talking to. For instance, I was just showing you this further extra. It's a real journey in terms of all the holistic things and alternative things that I can do to help myself. So I've been having acupuncture, you're doing fertility yoga, I'm not going to read all of this, but it's just to show that this idea of stay positive and keep going and doing the attempt is very active in a lot of patients. But at the same time, when it comes to the clinician point of view, what they say is this seems to be the last must-have technology. There are certain things that you need to have, that you need to be in the position to offer to patients, because otherwise you're not a good clinic on the market. Mumsnet, which I didn't know what it was at the beginning of this research, but now it's clearly a kind of very relevant source, is shaping the market in the UK. And then he started to talk about the stories of how stories coming out of Mumsnet are actually shaping, according to this clinician. I'm not completely sure that this kind of narrative is just a narrative or is useful to justify certain things that are done, but in terms of not really conclusion, after the hype, after this kind of marketing experience, I think the positive in this story is that there's definitely an exponential increase of scientific publication and time-lapse, and they're producing a lot of new knowledge on embryo and embryology as a field. The diffusion of time-lapse against all the debate on evidence has been pretty large and is now available in most of the clinics in the UK. I'm not very convinced that all the narrative or the debate on evidence has sort of get the impact it wants to have, because of these 22 couple patients we actually interviewed, although they were being treated through the NHS, when we were asking, what do you think about the evidence debate, most of them were just saying they didn't know what we were talking about. And again, it was just the last point about the idea of this journey and how the idea of this journey is actually furthering the inequalities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, perhaps one more third speaker. Dr. Andrea Stoffel is a lecturer in sociology and anthropology of medicine in Norwich Medical School at the University of East Anglia. She holds a PhD from the University of Cambridge, and her research interests are in how society, culture, and history shape our understanding of how the body and mind are related, and how this in turn shapes our knowledge and understanding of health, illness, and disease. So, on the talk today, Andrea is going to focus on wearable medical devices, how these proposed devices for medical use are going to the marketplace, and the ways they're being used, which have served users' values and interests. So, I'll pass over to Andrea.
Thank you very much, of course. I also actually wanted to talk about a different piece of research that I've done with some colleagues in Germany and Switzerland and in the UK on Tunisia, because I thought it also fitted the bill. And it was basically research on hymen reconstruction. So it's basically clinics that you can see that also exist in London, where you can basically go as a woman and reconstruct your hymen, to have lost it through either sexual contact or being sexually abused, or it tearing anyway. So we've done research, or I was basically brought onto the project when the research was already done, because the team around it were basically medical ethicists and bioethicists from the University of Munich and Zurich, who actually didn't know what to do with the data. So I actually wanted to let you know a little bit about our process of interpreting the data, because it was a major challenge, and it took us about 4 years to actually finally manage to publish the paper, and it took me about a year to really come to terms with all the data that we found and find some kind of framework to interpret it. So what we basically found in this research is there's a situation of hope. So a lot of the women basically said, you know, even though they haven't had sexual contact with a man and they still had the hymen not intact, they really did hope that they would be marriageable again. So you basically can't get married if you don't have an intact hymen. So they really hoped to attract the husband. They really hope to conform to the expectations of this idea of purity, so the pure body that is basically kept pure by the hymen, and if it's no longer intact, it of course is no longer pure. So classical anthropological theory on purity and danger and purity. So they talked about that quite a lot. We had quite a few women who actually, once they basically confessed to their husbands that they had actually had undergone hymen reconstruction, they were actually left by their husbands. So complete shattering of that sort of hope. What we also found was that there is this co-construction, of course, between sort of very ancient cultural need of women to be intact and their purity to be protected, and the medical practice that has basically enabled the space to emerge as assemblage of people doing things and wanting things and needing things, and the medical establishment also providing for it. And we have actually found that it is increasingly globally prevalent. So we know about Tunisia, of course, and the sort of MENA countries, the Middle Eastern North African countries. And of course in London and in Vienna, I did some googling very quickly, and there was a massive major new market in China for clinics that offer this sort of surgery. What we found, or what the medical bioethicist who worked on the project found, was there's still no medical regulation, there's no medical research on it, there are no surgical standards, so it is completely underregulated in terms of medical practice and in terms of what we now use. There is called evidence-based medicine. You can know this, I've been teaching in medical school for a long time. So they always talk about evidence-based medicine. So I slipped into that. But the bioethicists also talk about that, and the medical ethicists, and adhere to that sort of standard and say, well, there has to be regulation in order to protect patients. No? We've had masses of debates around that. Online, on email, you cannot imagine how often we've discussed that issue. What we found was this sort of major moral ambivalence between about time and reconstruction among the patients. So most of the women that were interviewed, of course, said, well, it's completely crazy that we have to do it, but we have to do it, no? In order to increase the hope that they're going to get married or that the partner they want to marry will never find out that they don't have an intact timer for whatever reason. I said before already that there's still not enough medical research evidence about the risk involved, and there are no standards, and increasingly I subscribe to that perspective that some kind of regulation is necessary, of course, and research to basically fill in that sort of regulation is, of course, should be, you know, evidence-based. What we also found, socially and personally, pre-mortal, basically, it did really change women's lives, you know, so they really did get married afterwards. So it was really something that changed, not just, it did change their lives, yes. One of the arguments that we came up with at the end of our paper was, of course, that we said promulgation of gender injustice, it does contribute again to major gender injustice again, the sort of imagined future that women always have to work for, whereas of course men don't have to do that. What it also does, it allows women to have a sexual response to, personal response to sexual violence, so they can actually undo something that has been done to them. And we came up with this very big ethical conundrums that we tried to resolve in the paper and tried to argue through. So if women actually want it, why not enable them to do it? So we've discussed that, and we had several different personal experiences on that. And I managed in the end to convince the bioethicist, the medical ethicist, to somehow subscribe to my perspective or my approach, which was this sort of more pragmatic approach, approaches to using medicine for your own personal benefits. What's wrong with that? What the medical ethicists saw as a bigger problem was that it is not regulated and that we need to somehow bring it out into the open and protect women from having to do it, so having to have it as a new standard that is somehow now enabled by medical technology. So just giving you a little background on our debate that we had, which approaches were actually helpful to analysis, and we then did stick with the pragmatic approach rather than a sort of prescribed approach, or rather a sort of ethical standardization, which we also suggested in the paper we would actually need in the future to regulate the sort of what's going on underground. So classic question of, you know, what happens already, how can we regulate it, rather than ignore and deny it. So that was one of the debates we had. I wanted to present you with another paper, a research, actually a book contribution that we wrote, Anna Smigel and myself, who I haven't mentioned on here, my colleague who's a bioethicist, an ethicist out of medicine, which we wrote about keepsake ultrasound. And it was actually the paper, oh my God, I've only got 2 more minutes. So anyway, it's about keepsake ultrasound window to the womb. And it's personal medical, what we would refer to as personal medical device, PMDs, that you can actually use for your own personal use. So it's very similar to the Fitbits. And we thought about how we can analyze that. We did not write about Fitbits because we decided we're going to talk about a medical technology that has been devised for the medical market but now has become available on the high street, which is a very fascinating phenomenon, or it is the other way around. So it was designed for medical technology. In the UK, also not regulated, so you can go and buy an ultrasound machine, and you can open a shop and do sort of window to the room, so you can actually do it. You don't need a certificate for it. So it is entirely driven by the market. Basically, people want to be able to show pictures of their babies or the fetus. We argued at the time, again, that it's not used very differently again to medical, the way medicine works. It was not used to treat or diagnose. It's basically only there to monitor and regulate your own body and product of your body, so to speak. What we, how we did analyze it at the time was really taking those four medical ethics, bioethical principles, and look at what it does to people for it actually. So autonomy, you could also always argue that medical devices, personal medical devices, increase autonomy, but it actually doesn't, because a lot of people do not have the expertise to interpret what they actually see or what they measure. We also argued against the argument that it is beneficial for the patient. So we can discuss that actually in the discussion. And then we discussed also non-maleficence, so do not harm. And at the end, we discussed justice, which again is a biomedical principle. And again, I'm going to finish here. We can discuss that in the discussion, as I said. But anyway, that's what we came up with. So thanks for listening.
Thank you very much. Does anyone have any quick questions from the room? No? Okay. I'm absolutely fascinated yet. We'll come back to some of your last points in the discussion. So finally, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Elizabeth Tu, who is a lecturer in Science and Communication in the Centre for History of Science, Technology and Medicine at the University of Manchester. She received her PhD from the University of Pennsylvania, and her research interests are social and cultural dynamics that inform expert and lay relationships around medical knowledge. And today she's going to share some insights from her research on the cervical smear, the mammogram, and routinized prevention at the onset of introduction in 1960s and 70s. Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Sorry.
We're going back in time a little bit. This is from a larger project that I'm doing called Making Screening Work. And what I'm looking at is the introduction of the cervical smear and the mammogram, two of the primary forms of cancer screening, that some of the first forms of cancer screening that were introduced in the UK and that were, of course, aimed primarily at women. So lots of what we have talked about and lots of the literature around the history of cancer screening, and particularly around women's cancer screening, has focused on a couple of different areas. For instance, in 1963, the gynecologist Hugh McLaren from Birmingham made this little illustration, which he called the cytologist dilemma, which was what to do. There are some cells in cervical cancer or precancer that are clearly angelic and not cancerous, and some that are clearly cancerous, but the cytologist's problem is what to do with the cells in the middle that are somewhere in the case of transformation. And this question of how things like cervical screening align the boundaries between disease and illness, how they bring us to a state of thinking of being at increased risk as being equated with pre-cancer or even having cancer. And that's an issue that's been addressed very well by a lot of scholars, like Ilana Lowy has written very beautifully about this. The other context in which people have considered this, there's a nice illustration from Spare Rib, the feminist magazine, where the doctor is saying, "You look a lot better now that I've removed everything," from the early 1980s. The fact that women's cancer screening, particularly smears and mammograms, are incredibly interventive procedures. And talking about them, we have to talk about them in the context of these questions about women's agency and women's collective political action around intervention, whether it's seen as being overly interventive or, as I'll show, a little strangely not interventive enough. And, of course, the other context for thinking about the history of women's cancer screening is this context of questions about, well, does screening work? Does it work as a population-level intervention that is economically worthwhile and brings enough benefits to justify its cost? And that is a very long discussion that has been going on since, 1957. but in particular, it has come out most forcefully around the question of breast cancer screening in the last few years. My project, what I want to do is I really want to come at it, since other people have written about that quite beautifully, I want to go on and think about questions about, well, how has screening been made to work as an intervention, particularly in the UK context? How is it that intimate, intrusive medical interventions are made worthwhile to the people who either perform them or the people who undergo them? How are they made palatable, expected, and ubiquitous to the point where we make jokes about cervical smears? It's a sort of go-to experience that people talk about as something you don't want to get, like going to the dentist. Furthermore, if this was the first wave of a new kind of prevention, how was this integrated into the healthcare system more broadly? How is it that the healthcare system managed to convince all of us to expect women to undergo these procedures? Here, women are sort of the leading edge of this new form of prevention that would eventually spread to things like bowel cancer, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, how do healthcare workers learn to screen people, and how do women learn to be screened? How is this experience understood? How do we fit it into our healthcare system? How do we fit it into our lives? Big questions, obviously, not going to answer them in 10 minutes. What I wanted to do was give you a very brief overview of some things that I found about the history of cervical screening from the 1960s through the 1980s. And here, because I teach a lot of health communication, I wanted to remind you that an awful lot of screening, the intervention is actually health education, right, is promoting the practice as much as it is doing it. Well, what happens with cervical screening is when it is introduced in the UK, it actually starts in the 1950s as a diagnostic procedure. Cervical smears are a diagnostic procedure, and they're mostly done in gynecological specialists or outpatient clinics. But after a lot of pressure from a variety of groups, there is a push to make it a test that is more available and that gynecological specialists can give to opportunistic cases. For instance, they say, well, actually, you should be doing the smear on every woman who comes into your gynecology outpatient clinic because it is useful for that. And then there's a big push to move from there to make it a routine screening procedure, not something that's given to people who are symptomatic, but rather given to everyone to pick up cases that otherwise would not be found. At the same time, the smear moves in where it's being done. It moves from being done in specialty clinics only to community clinics, including family planning association clinics, to being given in a variety of community practice contexts, most notably the GP's office. The way that this happens, there's a coalition of professionals and a coalition of women's activists and advocates from places like the Medical Women's Federation that are pushing very hard to say that the UK needs cervical cancer screening at the population level. Everyone else has it. The CYTO test, as they call it, is available to American women who want it. Even East Germany has it, they say. Why doesn't Britain, right? A very typical argument made around health services. So by the late 1960s, it becomes official. They shift from trying to offer the service as much as possible through a variety of venues to say the UK will adopt a population-level screening program for cervical cancer, primarily based on cervical smears. Well, and promptly afterwards, they begin to face a lot of problems after spending a lot of money putting together centers that are going to read the smears, training up people to collect the smears and read them. They've spent a lot of money introducing this procedure because, of course, they have to do something that will allow all women in the UK in the appropriate age group to be screened. And already, shortly after they've introduced this, within about a year, they're facing a lot of problems because a number of economists and other kinds of efficiency experts involved in looking at medical evidence have profound skepticism about the value and whether or not screening is worthwhile as an intervention at a population level. Is this the best way to spend money? At the same time, they find that the uptake of screening is not nearly as high as they had hoped it would be. And one could say, maybe that's because a lot of women got it before while they were agitating for it. But they do a lot of studies and they find, for instance, that whether or not a woman is screened or whether a GP delivers screening is actually closely tied to attributes of that GP's quality of practice. Things like, is there a receptionist? Is there an appointment system? Is it a group practice? And it turns out a lot of GPs don't qualify at that point of offering a kind of modern service. They're practicing a much older kind of GP practice. So the problem could be located in women's willingness to get the service. The problem could be located in the system that provides it. Obviously, okay, obviously the discussion ends up focusing on, well, the problem actually is that the wrong women are getting screened, they decide. The problem is that low-risk women, women at low risk, are very demanding and want to get lots of smears, so they're misusing the system that way, while high-risk women, women who are older, lower educational attainment, members of minority ethnic groups, et cetera, tend to avoid services. So the usual double bind, you're either being too demanding or you're not using the services which have been provided, quote, at great cost, as they frequently remind. And so they developed this whole language about how are we going to think about people who don't respond, people who don't accept. There are also challenges around how to manage the information. One really important thing that isn't very often talked about is the fact that this whole system of managing population-level samples and population-level medical data emerges at the same time that the NHS is grappling with how are we going to computerize? They have problems around things like, do we have a complete list of all women between the ages of 30 and 55 in the UK? Where would we find that? These kinds of questions are pivotal to running an efficient, valuable screening service. Because they're so concerned, though, about women not actually turning up for the service, they spend a lot of time trying to encourage women to partake of screening, go get the test, by modeling the process of getting the test. And partly that's because they're not going to show you what actually happens when you're getting a smear, but often they're anxious to dissuade people of their fears about the test, but also to point out it's quick, it's easy, and you'll get the information right away. This is from a pamphlet that was created for women of a, quote, lower socioeconomic status. Here's another one with Jenny, Sharmila, and their nameless black friend, who go to the post office to find out where they can get a smear, as you do. this is the kind of, and obviously they offer these kinds of pamphlets in different languages. So what they're doing is they're trying to make the process of screening closer to the people that they think are unwilling to get it or unable to get it, and they're trying to make the process itself more familiar. Very briefly, what happens after that is that there are repeated scandals around the mismanagement of information. Results, either tests are not processed, they're not processed quickly enough, there are huge backlogs, the results aren't sent out properly, they aren't sent out to the right people. Sometimes women are told, well, if you don't hear from us, everything's okay. That's not the way to manage medical information. And there are two sort of things that happen in the late 70s and early 80s around this. First, there are a group of people who take to activism. This is from Edinburgh, a group of community activists who are saying, you have to reform this system for us. Otherwise, in the media, there are these discussions of what's often called a shambles of cancer testing, and headlines like a dying mother accuses the hospital. And there are a variety of positions available, a variety of identities that people can take on. Of course, this is not in, this didn't stop happening in the 1970s. This is from last week. There are still arguments about how well we manage information, the medical information that is collected as part of this process. So my questions here for today are really sort of two. I don't have much to say about hope, but I have been thinking about how it is that women, as patients or as everyday people, claim and mobilize identity and agency when faced with a system that is claiming to provide them with a service. And how is it that others attribute identity and agency to them? Again, we get back to the wrong women, the women who demand too much service and the women who consciously reject services that have been laid on at great price. Second, I really want to stress, what do we learn by looking at questions of experience, agency, behavior, and change, by looking at not shiny technologies? The cervical smear, well, it changes over the course of this period, but it often turns out that the real problem with the system has nothing to do with the smears themselves. It has to do with computerization, with the management of the forms, with the sending of the samples around. And in essence, the failures are routine failures of a bureaucratic system. So my question is, how can we learn about persistent inequities and misunderstandings from both sides when we're looking at sort of the technology that is not novel, the everyday technology of managing medical information? Okay. Sorry to have gone over.